This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. After more than a year of the pandemic, we are hearing more about the return of live music festivals this summer and into the fall here in Chattanooga and the Tennessee Valley. Barry Corder covers this scene as a reporter for the Chattanooga Times Free Press. Barry, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Live music is springing back to life all around us here in the Chattanooga area and this corner of the Southeast.
All over. And I've got a bunch of schedules pulled up on my computer so I can talk with some actual information. And man, the middle of September, beginning and middle of September is going to be crazy. If depending on where you want to be, you can find something. It's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out.
And on the way to September, I'm just thinking the next few weeks. I'm thinking the next few months. I'm thinking about, for example, Nightfall. I'm thinking about Riverfront Nights.
Absolutely. Yeah, I keep pointing to fall, and I keep forgetting about the fact that not only that, the Bonnaroo Farm has started having events there. Nightfall will start next month. Riverfront Nights will get started about then. So yeah, there's plenty. And the festival at the end of this month, I guess, down at Cherokee Farms Forward Fest. That's a great one. That's a great location if people have never been. It's a beautiful setting. Perfect for festivals like this.
How are these events planning to handle whatever protocols may still be in place or adjust? Because it seems every day there's a new adjustment now.
That's exactly right. It remains to be seen. That's a question that I ask all of the organizers, of course, whenever I talk to them. And Bonnaroo, for example, in Manchester, an hour from here, is sold out at 80,000 tickets. Moon River plans to be 11,000 tickets. Nightfall, they can't really limit because it's a free open space. So I think her intention is, like everybody, is to just hope that people are careful and make good decisions and have gotten vaccinated. That has been the key that seems to have loosened everything up. But you still don't know if the guy next to you has been vaccinated or not. So it's going to be interesting. We've been talking about it for a year. You know, shoulder to shoulder with people was always kind of odd if you were at all germophobic. Now people will be more aware, I would think. Then you throw in public bathrooms and all those sorts of things. So I honestly don't know. I plan to go to a lot of these events, especially in the fall. It's a game day decision. That's the only way I know how to put it. Legally, technically, what I'm hearing is most of them are saying you're on your own. You can't hold us responsible. We'll probably be seeing signage to that effect and verbiage on flyers and tickets and some of that sort of thing. It's still uncharted. Fluid. I keep hearing words like fluid and game day and we'll see and don't know. But the plan is to open up and have these events.
And as fluid as these events are, as we plan to open up and stage them, what sense do you have that any of these events have to be make or break because of the past year, how brutal that was for the music industry, despite any infusions of money that might be coming from Washington, D.C. or Nashville or wherever?
I would say huge. I mean, they're all, for the most part, hand to mouth. A bad rain year can kill one. We saw it happen in Birmingham. We saw it happen in Atlanta with some of their earlier festivals and series. A really bad weather year just killed it. So that can still happen. You've got some of the bigger ones, the Bonnaroos, the Lollapaloosas. You know, they have sort of a rainy day fund that they try to build in, but one or two bad years can kill them. Burning Man just announced it's not going to happen for the second year in a row. That's a huge financial hit to the area. Part of the reason I know that they are so insistent on happening this year is just the question that you ask. They can't survive another year without it. In a lot of cases, they had contracts signed for 2020, and a lot of those acts have kept the door open. You know, they tried to make it work even through a postponement after a postponement. A lot of them thought they could go this summer and then move to the fall. They can't just keep putting them off, especially now that other places are starting to book acts. So they got to get out and work. The bands have been shut down for as long as the festivals had. So everybody's anxious to get back out and get paid.
I think about that a lot when I think of Riverfront Nights and Riverbend, which was already in the process of retooling before the pandemic hit, or beyond concert series, Songbirds.
Yeah, Songbirds, the museum, everything as we know it is gone. It's gone, gone, gone. I hope everyone understands that. It's confusing to a lot of people. The foundation is coming back and we'll be having live shows in the former museum space. So the great news is the foundation was doing terrific work with its Guitars for Kids program. Thousands of kids have already benefited. On a personal note, the big giant neon sign above the building was done by my sister's company. It doesn't have to go away. It's a beautiful sign. As I've joked, it's too big to fit in my basement, so it needed to stay where it was.
And if the choo-choo sign can stay where it is, then that sign can stay there.
Yeah, that will still work. The downstairs space, Brian Joyce, who people will know from WGOW, is going to be running a bar. That's the other thing to make clear. Really two spaces divided by a rolling door. He'll have the front space, the smaller space, and it will be a bar. And then the back space where the stage used to be will probably not have live music. It will probably be a restaurant. I would feel pretty certain about that.
Circling back to everything that is lined up for the fall, there is Bonnaroo, there is Moon River, and on and on and on.
And Riverbend. Riverbend will be in October. As you pointed out, they were in the process of retooling. Probably be 3 days. It'll probably be three stages. Very small. The barge was already gone, so it's not going to be the 35 to 55,000 people in that range. Probably be more like, you know, a city festival or a Riverfront Nights, probably for three nights type of thing. Maybe bigger, but similar. The Moon River, what's interesting is Bonnaroo is September 2nd, that first week, Labor Day weekend, that week. And then the next week is Moon River here at Coolidge Park. And then a month later will be Riverbend. I just got an email. Pitchfork in Chicago is that same weekend as Moon River. I think Railbirds is in Lexington is real close. That's why I say it. They're all right on top of each other. And I was talking with Drew Holcomb, the founder, co-founder of Moon River the other day. And I hadn't heard this before, but he said the no compete radius clause that a lot of these festivals have had in the past, there seems to be a gentleman's agreement that that's out the window this year. That's a clause that if you book to sign, play Bonnaroo or Moon River, you can't play anywhere within a couple hundred miles on depending 4 to 6 weeks on either side. So that's why you're seeing a lot of the same artists on many lineups, even if they're close to each other. As he said, everybody's in the same boat. Everybody needs to be successful. Everybody wants everybody to be successful. So, you know, then the question becomes two of them. And I hadn't thought about this. Are there enough people with enough money to support all of these in such a condensed time frame? And then what might it do to the venues, the individual venues? You know, if you've got 100 acts on a festival lineup and they're playing every other week or every week, who's going to be playing the Tivolis and the Memorial Auditoriums and the Signals and all that? So there's still a lot to figure out. At one point, I had heard, this was a couple months ago, that the numbers of acts that were sort of lined up in the queue on hold to play some venues, especially in bigger cities, was 7, 8, 9 deep. They all had hold dates. They were just that anxious to get out and start playing again. And so all that has to be figured out. You can only play one place at a night. So all that has to be figured out, and the multitude of all these festivals, what will it do to the venue? So the good news is, I keep saying, is it's now being talked about in ink and not pencil. You know, contracts are being signed, dates are being held, posters are being printed, tickets are being sold. So it's actually happening.
People who have not been on stage, they want to get on stage. People who have not been out, they want to get out and they want to see these acts.
Yeah, definitely. That's a curious point too. And going back to what we talked about earlier, the timing, it still pretty much feels like fall. I hear from a lot of bands that, yeah, we're anxious and we're ready to get out. But then I hear from a few that say, no, maybe the bass player, the singer's not ready, or the crew is not ready. So it's shifting now, but as recently as a couple of weeks ago on our podcast, one of the guests that we had as a booking agent said she had actually had a band turn down 4 different offers for the next several weeks. They just weren't ready. It's a little bit of both. The vaccine really seems to have been the game changer. It's a tangible defense, it feels like, for a lot of people. You know what I mean? The mask, some people believe in it, some people don't. Even the ones who do, you know, would argue, well, I don't know what the guy next to me's done. So there was still that unknown. The vaccine gives people a little bit more faith, it seems like. That's what I'm hearing anyway.
Tell us more about the podcast these days.
Sure. Thanks for asking. It's called The What Podcast. I started it with a guy named Brad Steiner, who's a radio guy. He was here, and he's now down in New Orleans, where he runs a cluster of radio stations. We started it as almost a lark. We were going to Bonnaroo every year, loved it, realized that pretty much every time we got together, we talked about Bonnaroo, and figured probably other people do too. And then that year, 2016, was arguably their weakest lineup ever. And we thought, well, it'd be interesting to do a podcast, sort of a deep dive into the 70% of the acts we've never heard of, and found out pretty quickly that a lot of other people agreed, liked it a lot. Like I said, I think we thought we'd do 7-8 episodes, and it's become a year-round thing. We've got people from all over the country who listen, who have been on the show. And then about 2.5 months ago, out of nowhere, well, I know how it happened. We started getting industry guests, not just musical acts that were on the lineup or listeners. When especially the pandemic, I hate to say benefited us, but it kind of did, because it forced us to broaden our approach. It wasn't a festival. So we started getting entertainment attorneys, people who actually booked the festivals, people who booked bands. And the people at Consequence of Sound heard that one episode that we had with two people who are nationally, internationally known. I mean, they book big time acts. It was a really great show. They loved it and reached out and said, we think you'd be a good fit for our network. They have 9 other podcasts. So we're now part of the Consequence Podcast Network, which I say, you know, self-promotion, but also because I think it proves kind of the reason you and I are talking, is there's a lot of interest in festivals and live music. And Brad and I come at it. First of all, he's very good at radio. You know, I've newspapers for 30 something years. So we're both pretty good at interviewing bands and all that, but we're also huge fans of festivals. So it has that combination of inside baseball stuff and just plain fanboy stuff. And it seems to work. So it's going to be interesting. It means now we're doing it every week, and it means they want us to broaden beyond Bonnaroo. So we'll be doing probably attending 4 or 5 other festivals this summer and fall, just basically letting people know why we like these festivals so much. That's pretty exciting.
And where can we find the podcast?
You can find it on consequence.net or thewhatpodcast.com. It's on every iTunes, all of them, iHeart, Anchor. Consequence is part of the Anchor system, I guess. So YouTube, we actually record. I don't know why. Just stare at people talking, but it's a lot of people, that's where they find their music especially. So we're on all those platforms.
All right, Barry, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Ray. Always a pleasure.
Same here.
A Chattanooga firm is working with NASA on a device that could be connected to your smartphone to detect COVID-19 in your breath. It is called the E-Nose. George Yu is the CEO and founder of Variable, a sensor technology business.
George, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Tell us how you and your team began working on this prototype COVID-19 detection device.
This goes back to, I think the initial conversation started in April or May of 2020, kind of really in that, just after the lockdown started. And kind of this, the nation's in crisis, no one could get a test, there's a crazy pandemic going on. And so NASA wanted to have their own sort of push to help with the testing. So they look at their portfolio, what can they do to help with the testing crisis? And they selected my former colleague at NASA, Dr. Jing Li, and her technology was the breath detection. And so they received a rapid fund from Department of Health and Human Services. And she immediately gave me a call. I still remember that call quite well. You don't get a call like that very often. She said, George, I know you're working on your own company now, but we really need some help here. You have just the right expertise. You worked on similar devices before, and you could actually help us take this into a rapid development mode and push this thing forward. And so that was quite an honor to be asked to do that. And so we obviously discussed internally at the company, saying, even though this is not our primary business, I think the fact that for a good cause and for the national priority, we should try to contribute to whatever we can.
And then how does this device work?
So this device works by looking at something called a volatile organic compound that's in everyone's breath. So volatile organic compounds is a big class of all sorts of different organic vapors. People would consider, like, for example, bad breath is considered as a type of volatile organic compound. Perfume is a type of volatile organic compound. And so your body spews out quite a bit of this stuff when you breathe. And depending on your illness, especially when you're talking about a respiratory illness, such as COVID, the compound that your body's spewing out of your breath is actually slightly different than if you're infected versus not infected. And that's the differentiation that they're looking for to give at least a pre-screening for people, say, if they have COVID or not.
Now, this kind of detection instrument usually is quite bulky, but the prototype that you have developed and you and your colleagues are working on is meant to be connected to a smartphone.
Yeah, so usually instruments like this are quite a large box in a laboratory, and that's traditionally where they are for testing purposes. The variable was selected mainly for our competence in past experience in the engineering of this type of instruments and also in our miniaturization capabilities. So we can turn that big box in the lab into a very small handheld device. We have done it in the past, at least my experience in the past builds on that. And we're also selected because we manufacture products. We're not just another research lab or another R&D facility. When we do things, when we design things, we have mass production as a key part of the consideration.
And then what more work needs to be done to get there from prototype to out in the field?
So we have delivered our phase one device to NASA, and NASA is now in the process of testing it in the laboratory in the beginning, and now they're starting to move into field trials with actual patient breath to test the device. Likely, there will be some more iteration that would need to occur before this is really ready for a larger scale.
And given that the timeline, it could be months, it could be into the next year, but whenever this does come to fruition, this is going to come in handy, whether we're still dealing with COVID-19 or a variant or many, many other applications.
That's correct. The eNote device is potentially a really good platform in that the technology is capable of looking for many other diseases beyond COVID. And even though COVID was with the genesis of why we had a strong push to move this thing forward, the technology can yield many benefits for other disease detection as well.
Give an example or two.
So there are some common ones. A lot of it is respiratory based, but there are many cancers that can be detected with the breath, depending on the type. You have seen probably articles where they have trained dogs to smell people's breath to detect if you're sick or not. It's a very much a similar concept. Dog's nose is extremely sensitive to volatile organic compounds, and they're probably one of the best sensors there is. But you can't not easily have too many dogs. It's not a scientific way of detecting. It's not so easy to have dogs in the hospitals trying to detect patients.
All right, George, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Ray.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon from Barking Legs Theatre, we have the second half of a set of guitar instrumentals by the gifted Chattanooga guitar player, Alan Chico. Thank you.
as Alan Wyatt would say. Almost, almost. That's for you, Sean. I'd like to move in a very different direction now and swap guitars. And everyone always remarks that they really like the look of this other one here, this darker top guitar, which is shockingly a very inexpensive guitar, but it's just, it is pretty amazing what they can do these days. Got guitar making pretty much figured out at this point, I think, if they can make a guitar for this price that looks and sounds and plays like this. Not complaining. I would like to play a tune now that is pretty special to me and has a quick little story to go along with it, which has to do with this very place here at Barking Legs, right here in the theater. And put this tuner on and kind of get this settled. The reason I have this second guitar is it's in a wacky alternate tuning. Those of you that play any guitar out there watching tonight, make sense out of that. Go figure. But I'll let that settle for a minute while I tell you a little bit about this piece. So many, many years ago, almost 20 years ago at this point, I think it was my junior year of high school, sophomore or junior year, I can't remember. But I'd been playing classical guitar very seriously for 4 or 5 years at that point, and I had just kind of gotten into jazz and really started to discover some other, let's say, serious instrumental guitar music. So fingerstyle players that were playing, you know, pop and rock music and jazz and kind of their own creations that was very much outside of the classical realm, but that I could tell was something much different than what was on offer on the radio, for example. So I was very much interested in finding more of these kinds of artists. And of course, this was back, you know, very much pre-YouTube, no streaming services or anything, and really kind of almost pre-Napster days, if you were a music pirate back in the day. So really finding out about new artists was like from friends, and maybe if you went to the links page on an artist's website, you'd have like a few other guitarists that they liked, and they would link to their, you know, webpage or whatever. And I think this was one of those cases, and somehow I got linked to a page of a guitarist named Preston Reed, who's a fantastic steel string fingerstyle player, and he really pioneered this. I'm not going to be playing this way tonight, but he plays with his left hand this way, over the top, almost piano style, and does kind of slap and pop tricks. And very, very amazing and unique guitar style. So I was amazed by this player, and he played a tune on this video called Ladies' Night. And it was a title track off of a record of his, early record of his. And so I immediately got that at like Tower Records or something, or Media Play or something. Everybody remember Media Play? That was a great store. That was a great weekend entertainment that I feel like is now lost to the digital age. That was like every Saturday for most of my teenage years was going to Media Play. But so I had this Preston Reed record, was really, really digging on it for several months. And then a friend of mine at school, actually not at my school, he was a friend through church and played in some student bands and stuff. He called me up and he was like, dude, Preston Reed's playing at Barking Legs. And I said, what the hell is Barking Legs? And he was like, it's right down the street from your school. You've never been to Barking Legs? So it shows you, you know, how worldly I was then as a teenager, not even knowing about amazing places like this right in my own backyard. So I immediately got a ticket, and it was serendipity, really. And so a couple of us came down here and sat right out there in the theater and enjoyed this wonderful Preston Reed concert. And I was expecting all of the theatrics and the slap and pop guitar and all the things that I knew from this video and record that I'd heard from him, and was prepared for quite the show. And we did get quite the show in that regard, but I was equally amazed by the fact that behind him right here was an arc of about 6 or 7 different types of guitars. And I'm talking like a Fender Stratocaster, like a Martin steel string acoustic, a big old hollow body jazz guitar, a classical guitar. He had every single kind of guitar, and he would play a couple tunes on each one, nothing like what I heard on his records. And the real standout tune for me that night, and one that's really stuck with me since, was this beautiful jazz ballad that he played on that hollow body guitar. And I'll never forget that moment hearing that, because I think it was one of the first times in my life that I heard somebody play something that was not classical guitar, that was a solo guitar style, very distinct from what I had been exposed to at that point, that was considered and serious and thoughtful, and the audience was just whisper quiet. And I thought, wow, that's amazing that there's something outside of the classical guitar world that's equally as rewarding and intimate in that regard. So I'm going to play that tune for you now. This is First Summer Without You by Preston Reed. I guess this is dedicated to this wonderful place, Barking Legs. Thank you. play a couple more for you. Next, apologies, I will have to retune slightly. You know, all the jokes about guitar players. Also, we classical guitarists have to be super nerdy. And instead of making guitar jokes, we make lute jokes, jokes about luteness, you know, when you're in an academic setting in university teaching classical guitar. And the jokes about luteness are, you know, you spend half your life tuning and the other half playing out of tune, right? Of course, that joke's been recycled many times from any other instruments. It's especially true of the lute. It's also true of the classical guitar. But especially a lot of our literature requires a lot of retuning, and especially with these stage lights up here, it can drift a little bit. So apologies again for any of you out there with perfect pitch that are just, my ears are bleeding. This is a relatively new arrangement of mine. Really just finished maybe midway through last year, and I've actually only had, I think I've only performed it once. I think I've only had one opportunity to play it, and I think it was on the radio, maybe for Richard Wenham's show. But this is the great Jimmy Van Heusen classic, Here's That Rainy Day, a song I've always really loved. And again, like some other tunes I mentioned earlier, Darn That Dream and Spring Is Here, one I was really unsure about how to treat it, what to do with it, what I could say differently on it that was not just retracing over the lines already drawn by countless jazz musicians better than myself. So I think I found a way to get this tune out there in my own way. Here's That Rainy Day. Thank you. One more quick funny story before the last tune. I'll send you off with a nice tune. So Jimmy Van Heusen is the composer of Here's That Rainy Day. And I remember, I think I was playing at a jazz band concert in high school. I just started getting into jazz, and forget which tune we were playing, another Jimmy Van Heusen tune. And I noticed my dress shirt, my shirt and tie for the concert. It was from the department store. My mom got me my shirt for the concert, and the tag on it, the brand was Van Heusen. And I thought, I was so oblivious, just so in into music, and just knew almost nothing about anything else other than music. And I was so oblivious as a teenager that I thought, you know, wow, they named the shirt company after the great jazz composer, Jimmy Van Heusen. Of course, it's the other way around. It's a stage name. He named himself after the clothing company because I guess it sounded posh and classy. So Jimmy Van Heusen. Apologies for the tuning. Well, thanks so much for tuning in again. It's been a pleasure to be back. Thanks to Bruce for having me back, and I'll look forward to next time. Maybe in person, hopefully, who knows, but really we'll look forward to that day. But as a solo guitar player, I enjoy this too, because it's very quiet and intimate, and I can deliver my thing straight to your computer screen, which is fun, and so grateful for the crew here who's spent their night doing sound and video. So thank you guys, and I'll send you off with the appropriate titled tune, We Will Meet Again, by the great pianist Bill Evans. Next time.
Alan Chicot, a virtual performance from Barking Legs Theatre, who are taking faltering steps towards bringing live music back to the theatre for an audience. On Thursday, Amber Fultz will be playing live in the garden behind Barking Legs. The show will start at 7 o'clock. Details are on the Barking Legs webpage. This is listener-supported public radio, WUTC, in Chattanooga.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.